I thought you were walking with Gary and Yun. Ruth smiled then, and seemed as young and beautiful as when he had first met her so many years before. The cool gloom of the room disguised the little lines at the corners of her eyes, and the light streaking of silver in the dark hair drawn back from her temples and caught with a ribbon at the back of her neck. They're waiting for me, but I slipped away for a moment to make certain that you had all you wanted. She smiled down at him, and then selected a cigar from the silver humidor and began to prepare it. I'll need an hour or two, he said, glancing at the pile of mail. What you really need, Sean, is an assistant. She cut the cigar carefully, and he grunted. You can't trust any of these young people, and she laughed lightly as she placed the cigar between his lips. You sound as old as the prophets. She struck a vesta and waved it to clear the sulphur before she held it to the tip of the cigar. It's a sign of old age to mistrust the young. With you beside me, I'll be young forever, he told her, still awkward with a compliment after all these years, and she felt her heart swell with her love, knowing the effort it had required. She stooped quickly and kissed his cheek, and with a speed and strength that still astonished her, one of his thickly muscled arms whipped around her waist, and she was lifted into his lap. You know what happens to forward young ladies, don't you? He grinned at her, his eyes crinkling wickedly. Sean, she protested in mock horror. The servants, our guests. She struggled out of his embrace with the warmth and wetness of his kiss still on her lips, together with the tickle of his whiskers and the taste of his cigar, and rearranged her skirts and her hair. I am a fool, she shook her head sorrowfully. I always trust you. And then they smiled at each other, lost for a moment in their love. My guests, she remembered suddenly, a hand flying to her mouth. May I set the tea for 4 o'clock? We'll have it down at the lake. It's such a lovely day. When she had gone, Sean wasted another minute staring after her through the empty doorway into the gardens. Then he sighed again contentedly and drew the silver salver of mail towards him. He worked quickly, but with care, pencilling his instructions at the foot of each page and initialing them with a regal SC. No, but tell them politely, SC. Let me have the previous year's figures of purchase and delay the next shipment against bank guarantee, SC. Why did this come to me? Send it to Barnes, SC. Agreed, SC. To Atkinson for comment, please, SC. The subjects were as diverse as the writers. Politicians, financiers, supplicants, old friends, chancers, beggars. They were all there. He flicked over a sealed envelope and stared at it for a moment, not recognising the name or the occasion. Mark Anders, Esquire, Natal Motors, West Street, Durban. It was written in the hand that was so bold and flourishing that nobody could mistake it for any other but his own, and he remembered sending the letter. Somebody had written across the envelope, left, no forwarding address, return to sender. Sean clamped the cigar in the corner of his mouth and slit the flap with a Georgian silver paper knife. The card was embossed with the regimental crest. The Colonel-in-Chief and the officers of the Natal Mounted Rifles request the pleasure of Mark Anders, Esquire, at a regimental reunion dinner to be held at the old fort. Sean had written in the boy's name in the blank space, and at the end of the card, do try to come, S.C. Now it was returned, and Sean scowled. As always, he was impatient and frustrated by even the slightest check in his plans. Angrily, he tossed both card and envelope into the wastepaper bin, and they both missed, fluttering to the carpet. Surprisingly, even to himself, his mood had altered. And though he worked on, he fumed and gruffed now over his correspondence, and his instructions became barbed. The man is a fool or a rogue or both. Under no circumstances will I recommend him to a post of such importance, despite the family connection. S.C. After another hour, he had finished, and the room was hazed with cigar smoke. He lay back in the chair and stretched voluptuously like an old lion, then glanced at the wall clock. It was 5 minutes short of 4 o'clock, and he stood up. The offending card caught his eye again, and he stooped quickly and picked it up, reading it again as he crossed the room, tapping the stiff cardboard thoughtfully on the open palm of his hand as he limped out heavily into the sunlight and across the wide lawns. The gazebo was set on a constructed island in the centre of the lake, with a narrow causeway joining it to the lawns. Sean's household and guests were gathered there already, sitting about the table in the shade under the crazily contrived roof of the gazebo, with its intricate cast-iron work painted with carnival colours. Already a host of wild duck had gathered about the tiny island, quacking loudly for pieces of biscuit and cake. Storm Courtney saw her father coming across the lawns, and she let out one small excited squeak, leapt from the tea-table and flew down the causeway to meet him before he reached the lake. He lifted her easily, as though she was still a baby, and when he kissed her, she inhaled the smell of him. It was one of the lovely smells of her existence, like the smell of rain on hot, dry earth, or horses, or the sea. He had a special perfume, like old polished leather. When he lowered her, she took his arm and pressed close to him, matching her light, quick step to his limp. "How was your lunch appointment?" he asked, looking down on her shining, lovely head. And she rolled her eyes and then squinted ferociously. "He's a very presentable young man," Sean told her sternly. "An excellent young man." "Oh, Daddy, from you that means he is a weak-minded bore. Young lady, I'd like to remind you that he's a Rhodes Scholar and that his father is the Chief Justice."
"Oh, I know all that, but, Daddy, he just hasn't got any zing."
Even Sean looked for an instant nonplussed.
"And what, may I ask, is zing?"
"Zing is indefinable," she told him seriously. "But you've got to zing. You've got zing. You're the zingiest man I know."
And with that statement, Sean found all his fatherly advice and disapproving words gone like migrating swallows, and he grinned down at her, shaking his head.
"You don't really believe that I swallow all of your soft soap, do you?"
"You'll never believe it, Daddy, but Payne Brothers have got in 12 actual Patou Couture models. They're absolutely exclusive, and Patou is all the rage now.
Women in savage, barbaric colours, driven mad by those Machiavellian scheming monsters of Paris," growled Sean,
and Storm giggled delightedly.
"You're a scream, Daddy," she told him. "Irene's father has told her she may have one of them, and Mr. Lushar's is a mere tradesman."
Sean blinked to hear the head of one of the largest import houses in the country so described.
"If Charles Lushar's is a tradesman, what, pray, am I?" he asked curiously.
"You're landed gentry, a minister of the crown, a general, a hero, and the zingiest man in the world."
"I see." He could not help but laugh. "I see that I have a position to uphold. Ask Mr. Payne to send the account to me."
She hugged him again, ecstatically, and then for the first time noticed the card he still held in his hand.
"Oh," she exclaimed, "an invitation."
"Not for you, my girl," he warned her.
But she had taken it from his hand,
and her face changed as she read the name. Suddenly she was quiet and subdued.
"You are sending that to that salesperson?"
He frowned again, his own mood altering also.
"I sent it. It was returned. He has left without a forwarding address."
"General Smuts is waiting to talk to you." With an effort she recaptured the smile and skipped beside him. "Let's hurry."
"It's serious, old Sean. They are organised, and there is no question but that they are seeking a direct confrontation."
Jan Christian Smuts crumbled a biscuit between his fingers and tossed it to the ducks. They squabbled noisily, splashing in the clear water and chattering their broad flat bills as they dipped for the scraps.
"How many white workers will they lay off?" Sean asked.
2,000 to begin with," Smuts told him. "Probably 4,000 all in all. But the idea is to do it gradually, as the blacks are trained to replace them."
2,000, Sean mused, and he could not help but imagine the wives and the children, the old mothers, the dependents. 2,000 wage earners out of work represented much suffering and misery. "You like it as little as I do." The shrewd little man had read his thoughts. Not for nothing did his opponents call him Slim Yanni, or Clever Yanni.
2,000 unemployed is a serious business," he paused significantly. "But we will find other employment. We need men desperately on the railways and on other projects like the Foul Hearts irrigation scheme."
"They will not earn there the way they do in the mines," Sean pointed out.
"No,"
Jan Smuts drew out the negative thoughtfully.
But should we protect the income of 2,000 miners at the cost of closing the mines themselves?
Surely it's not that critical, Sean frowned quickly.
The chairman of the Chamber of Mines assures me that it is, and he has shown me figures to support this view.
Sean shook his head, half in incredulity and half in anguish. He had been a mine owner himself once, and he knew the problem of costs, and also the way that figures could be made to speak the language their manipulators taught.
You know also, old Sean, you especially, how many others depend for life on those gold mines.
It was a hard, probing statement, with a point like a stiletto. The previous year, for the first time, the sales of timber pit props from Sean's sawmills to the gold mines of the Transvaal had exceeded £2 million sterling.
The little general knew it, as well as he did.
How many men are employed by Natal sawmills, old Shawnee? 20,000?
24,000, Sean answered shortly, one blonde eyebrow lifted quizzically, and the Prime Minister smiled softly before going on.
There are other considerations, old friend, that you and I have discussed before. On those occasions it was you who told me that to succeed in the long term, our nation must become a partnership of black man and white, that our wealth must be shared according to a man's ability rather than the colour of his skin, not so?
Yes, Sean agreed.
It was I who said we must make haste slowly in that direction, and now it is you who hesitate and balk.
I also told you that many small steps were surer than a few wild leaps, made under duress, made only with an assegai at your ribs. I said, Yanni, that we should learn to bend so that we might never have to break.
Yanni Smuts turned his attention back to the ducks, and they both watched them distractedly.
Come on, Yanni, Sean said at last. You mentioned other reasons. Those you have given me so far are good, but not deadly urgent, and I know you are a politician enough to save the best until the end.
Yanni laughed delightedly, almost a giggle, and leaned across to pat Sean's arm.
Ha! We know each other too well.
We should, Sean smiled back at him. We fought each other hard enough.
They both sobered at mention of those terrible days of the Civil War.
And we had the same tutor, God bless him.
Yes, God bless him, echoed Jan Smuts.
And they remembered for a moment that colossus Louis Botha, warrior and statesman, architect of union and first prime minister of the new nation.
Come, Sean insisted. What is your other reason?
It is quite simple. We are about to decide who governs, the duly elected representatives of the people, or a small ruthless band of adventurers who call themselves trade union leaders, representatives of organized labor, or quite simply, international communism.
You put it hard.
It is hard, Sean, it's very hard. I have intelligent facts that I shall lay before the first meeting of the cabinet when Parliament reconvenes. However, I wanted to discuss these with you personally before that meeting. I need your support again, old Shawnee. I need you with me at that meeting.
Tell me, invited Sean.
Firstly, we know that they are arming with modern weapons, and that they are training and organizing the mine workers into war commandos.
Jan Smuts spoke quickly and urgently for nearly 20 minutes, and when he had finished, he looked at Sean.
Well, old friend, are you behind me?
Bleakly, Sean looked out into the future, seeing with pain the land he loved once more, torn by the hatred and misery of civil war. Then he sighed.
Yes, he nodded heavily. I am with you, and my hand on it.
You and your regiment?
Jan Smuts took the big bony hand.
As a minister of the government and as a soldier?
Both, Sean agreed. All the way.
Marion Littlejohn read Mark's letter sitting on the closed seat of the office toilet, with the door locked, but her love transcended her surroundings, discounted even the hiss and gurgle of water in the cistern suspended on its rusty downpipe above her head. She read the letter through twice, with eyes misty and a tender smile tugging uncertainly at her lips. Then she kissed his name on the final page and carefully folded it back into its envelope, opened her bodice and nestled the paper between her plump little breasts. It made a considerable lump there when she returned to the main office, and the supervisor looked out from his glass cubicle and made a show of consulting his watch.